Oh. Bonjour, Nenue Magneto. Bogotinen in this Nakaz magazine to them. Miss Quagamu is agagining, don't you bar? You would in a gachuanang is in a card again, dia no go. Miguich bizendoyeg. I greet you all as relatives. Thank you all for coming today to listen to me. My name is Alex Comet in English, and I also go by my Ojibwe name, Bogotinen. And I thank you all for coming to listen today to my presentation on the historical context of land access in the United States and modern impacts on indigenous peoples. Essentially, this is like a semester or two worth of college courses boiled down to in about 90 minutes. So it's a pretty dense and very interweaving topic throughout geography and time. And I'm really grateful for the 90 minutes to be able to unpack it. I've tried to present it a few times in 50 or 60 minute slots, and it's just so dense. It's really nice to have the extra time. So a bit about myself and how I've come into this type of work and what types of work I'm doing, because there's a lot of different facets of it. I'm a Red Lake Ojibwe citizen from the Eagle Clan, and I primarily have been working in language immersion education for the past decade. And then about 13 months ago, I came on with Marble Seeds, so this is my second conference season with them now. When I got hired, I was the farmer education specialist, and since then, have dropped back to part-time. We had opened up a charter school up in Red Lake where we try to focus on land-based learning. We focus on our food systems, and we teach it all within Ojibwe language. And our teachers needed a lot of support, so I had stepped off of our board of directors and picked up the curriculum developer role so that I could support our teachers better and help to stabilize things at our school a bit more. So a bit about my work with food systems. I got started growing marijuana out in the woods down in the Twin Cities and outside of Minneapolis when I was about 14. And from there, I just fell in love with growing plants and processing them. I've always been really into food, so I started harvesting wild rice a number of years ago. I don't remember how many years at this point. And also engaging in a lot of traditional foods, traditional medicines, like our changemaker organization, the Great Lakes Intertribal Food Collective, had mentioned earlier. This is like the zero wave or wave zero of the organic movement. Like we were always doing that since time immemorial. And I often hear about these terms like regenerative agriculture, and to me those get a little bit confusing because it's, you know, we were already interacting with our environment and living as a part of it, I'm tripping over my tongue because I got a little bit of brain fog from I'd gotten sick with COVID back in December, so bear with me a bit. Trying to take it smooth. So aside from our traditional foods, I also grow with my family out at Fond du Lac Reservation where I'm living. So this is more of a like modern agriculture. I'm not doing not conventional agriculture, but like planting seeds and going about the way that you all understand agriculture and gardening, the modern food system. So my family and I, we grow a lot of different vegetables, corn, beans, squash, several different varieties of each, several varieties of potatoes, hot peppers, onions, cucumbers, basically everything that my family loves to eat. My partner and I, we raise our children out there in the garden. So I've got a child that just turned 2 and another that'll be turning 5 shortly. And we try to raise them in this way that they understand their interrelationality with their environment and with their food system, that they know where everything comes from. My daughter, when she goes to plant her seeds, she talks about them like they're her babies. And when she talks about how she's going to take care of them in Ojibwe language, the terms that we use is literally to give it a drink. So, like, we treat everything pretty gently. And at the beginning of the season, I approach things, I approach the rest of the, like, where I'm going to be growing. I acknowledge that there's lots of bugs and mycelium and all types of things that are there. And I ask for their permission for even just disturbing the soil, because I know that's somebody else's home. So, and I'm coming here and disturbing that so that I can in turn eat. And that's just a little microcosm of my approach to how I live interrelational with the rest of my environment and the rest of creation. A bit about how this presentation came to be. Last year I had coordinated the convergence here at Marble Seed, and one of the topics that we were talking about was sustainability for tribal harvesters that are out there on the land and with the water. And it turned into like 2 hours of me just unpacking it for whoever was coming around. And I later on transcribed all the notes for it. We still have the book of proceedings coming out. We still have to send it through our branding to get the PDF all nice. But it captured a lot of that. I've been contemplating thinking about turning some of this type of information into a book to cover some of the history of the United States, and especially the Great Lakes region, which is more my specialty. But I've tried to explain it within this national context with more regional and local examples. And then from there, I presented it at the Upper Midwest Farmland Summit in Chaska, Minnesota, or Chanhassen, one or the other, back in November. And at that time, I was asked, because just some of the things I get into here, the organizing committee had actually asked me to keep it reasonable. And that was kind of a little bit of a trigger for me, like, what do you mean keep it reasonable? You know, there's a lot of unreasonable things that we live with throughout this reality we're all stuck in right now. And so I've continually been reformatting this in a way to provide more case examples and ways that show that, well, I'll get into all that later. Anyway, so a bit more about myself. As if I should be talking about myself. Anyway, I've got this picture of the cherry and the spoon here in Minneapolis. You know, very iconic imagery. I used to go there for, field trips when I was in elementary school. At the time, it was like this, you know, whimsical place to go see modern art. But then in my early adult life, visiting the sculpture garden, I was encountering a lot of homeless Native American people, specifically from my grandmother's community in Panema, which is one of the most isolated communities within northern Minnesota. And I kept asking myself, like, why am I seeing all these homeless people from my community, from my grandmother's community? How did all this come to happen? And I've come to, through my education, like I hold a Bachelor's of Arts in American Indian Studies and a Master's of Indigenous Education through Arizona State University. And just through my interaction with the agriculture sector, learning more and more history, like, it's very, very interrelated. So I really want to unpack it. And particularly with this Walker Art Center, I will get into that history as well too, but it's there's some painful history there. So I ended up finding myself homeless when I was So this would be 2013 until 2015, from October to October, so 2 years straight. And got to interact with a lot of people during that time. During the second year of homelessness, that's actually when I started working in education and with Ojibwe language revitalization, like not even having a home, but still just getting put up in a hotel every once in a while. And just not sure where I wanted to go with that exactly. But anyway, I survived that, and it's part of my story and part of why I'm passionate about this topic. And I just wanted to share that and be vulnerable with that. You know, it's like I say, it's a little bit painful, so it's hard to get like the words out on it exactly, you know. But without further ado, we'll jump into it. So going all the way back into 1492, and we have this concept called the Columbian Exchange, where there was certain things that were coming from the quote-unquote old world over here to the Americas, and then other exports that were going from the Americas back over to the rest of the world. And a lot of these crops that are like staples that everybody uses across the world were cultivated and developed here in the Americas, particularly in Mesoamerica, over the course of thousands of years, including beans, cacao, cashews, corn, peanuts, pecans, vanilla, avocado, cassava, chili peppers, guava, pimentos, pineapples, potatoes, pumpkins, squash, sweet potatoes, tomatoes, etc. All these things became major parts of world cuisine. And I tried to imagine what, you know, what would Italian beef food be like today without tomatoes, or any number of different dishes. And I know there's traditional dishes that everybody has in the rest of the world before that, but I just wanted to recognize these contributions and the fact that while this has been donated essentially to world culture, that we're still bearing a lot of this brunt and this poverty today. And in particular, a lot of the people in the descendants of the people that had initially cultivated throughout Mesoamerica, a lot of them had to deal with a lot of injustices today as well, particularly with the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, in 1994, which flooded the American markets with sweet corn, and we saw a lot of northern migration from indigenous peoples from Mesoamerica, Mexico, and further south coming back up here to the United States as well. And of course, there's a ton of issues that they face as well in terms of housing security, equal treatment. I'm sure you all have heard about the like children that were working in the meat packing plants in Minnesota. There was big expose in the news a few months ago about that as well. So these systems are just still in place where people are just kind of stuck being stepped on. So additionally, the way that indigenous people have been engaging in things like agroforestry, for example, the way that we were engaging in our traditional forest practices through use of fire, we had essentially been sustaining our land and water and forest for millennia. When settlers first came across, they had noticed that, well, they had seen essentially how the land had looked, and they started looking at it instead. I got a lot of brain fog going on right now. They essentially looked at the forest, and it looked like we weren't using it at all. And they used that as justification for further westward expansion and development throughout the woods, quote-unquote progress. And essentially, Yeah, I just used it as justification for colonization. But these days, now we're starting to see more of our traditional ways of how we were taking care of the environment are starting to become more popular. People are taking them and implementing them in different ways. I've been noticing there's a lot of hunger for Native knowledge. I recently presented for the Savannah Institute as well. They had Robin Wall Kimmerer as their keynote. And, you know, they had hundreds of people just listening to her. And it was just like a really good feel-good session. But I feel like there's more of it to unpack there. And rather than just having our indigenous traditional ecological knowledge influencing the rest of everything, I think we need to be centering these knowledges, centering the people that are holding them, bringing them up and bringing these communities up as well. Because the way that it's been done and is continuing to be done in a lot of instances is often very extractive. So there has to be this, as I'm mentioning here in my slides, I keep deviating from the slides when I'm talking, but our traditional ecological knowledge is essentially based on original law, or what I would call Chitinakonagewin in Ojibwe. And I view it as like our original treaty as human beings with the rest of creation. It sets up this reciprocal model of relationality, that for everything that we were given as people, that we have to give something back as well. We have a lot of teachings that are tied in with our creation story with that as well, specific offerings that we need to put down. And those are ways that we are continuing to maintain today. And I also emphasize the concept of Manajiituin, which is typically known as respect, but also my elders say it's also to go easy on one another as well, to take it easy on something, not to just use it up right away. So there's conservation built right into like our ways of knowing. So here I've got a map that's provided by Great Lakes Intertribal Fish and Wildlife Commission here in the Great Lakes region. They are an intertribal regulatory agency that protects treaty rights for, or treaty harvesting rights for, I believe about 11 communities, tribal communities, across all the lands that are here on this map. And the years that you see listed there are the years that treaties occurred between Native nations and the United States that outline a lot of rights that we are retaining to this day. So I wanted to also unpack a bit about treaties and what they are, because I've noticed when I spend time, say, on social media or looking in the comments sections on news websites, there's a lot of people that view treaties and treaty rights as quote-unquote outdated race-based laws. But in reality, this is, it's an agreement between nations. I have this quote here from the United States Senate, that treaties are binding agreements between nations and become part of international law. Treaties to which the United States is a party also have the force of federal legislation, forming part of what the Constitution calls the supreme law of the land. So when we talk about treaty rights, most people only talk about, well, those are for Native American people, but these are for everybody that's a citizen of the United States as well. It sets up the entire context for being able to like maintain your settlement, to live within the aforementioned treaty territories, because otherwise they would still be considered in full Native American land. But a lot of these treaties as well, they set up certain types of rights as well, and I'll get into that a bit deeper later. I also see in the comments sections a lot of people characterize it as a term of surrender for losing the war as well. And that somehow the victor is the one that's setting the narrative and everything, but Ojibwe people, we didn't go to war with the United States. We only engaged in treaty making process. So these are agreements, formal agreements between nations. And in fact, the last major battle happened on my father's reservation, Leech Lake, in 1889. And we won decisively. Major victory. So characterizing us losing the war is just straight up wrong. So it's a very easy cop-out for not recognizing treaty rights. And if you're not recognizing those rights, you're not recognizing the context with by which you're continuing to live here as well. So I wanted to present it from that angle as well, since I constantly see it just miscategorized. So each treaty stands as an agreement between governments that are between sovereign native nations and the federal government. And that puts tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction above that of state. So oftentimes, state law will not apply in reservations, but there is some complexity there with Public Law 280 as well. Being from Red Lake myself, for instance, the Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, cannot even step foot on our reservation without previously setting it up with our tribal government and getting permission to come on. They can't just, I believe even the, say the U.S., what is that, APHIS, the Animal Plant and Health Inspection Service, I believe they have to set that up as well. They can't just show up in surprise or do an audit or anything like that. They have to have their permission to come on. So as tribes, we also have our own conservation codes and regulatory agencies. I mentioned before the Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission. There's also an organization called the 1854 Treaty Authority, which they're not exactly, I'm not sure if they qualify as a regulatory agency per se, but they work to support the treaty rights that are within that treaty and for each of the signers as well. And each tribe also maintains its own resource management division. I know at Fond du Lac, where we're residents as well, they basically serve as like a public utilities council, pollution control agency, etc. They have EPA working through there. It's very complex office. Even when I just walk in there and just check out the maps they have on the wall, I'm just constantly learning something new. And I'm sure I don't have to mention, but most of the treaties, if not all of the treaties that the United States has engaged in with Native American peoples, has been broken in some form or another. So I really, really like maps ever since I was a little kid. I remember being like 8 years old and just cracking open a road atlas and just checking out, like, I know where that is, you know, like, if I were to just take and drive at 10, you know, how would I get to Cass Lake from the cities, you know, stuff like that. So I like to collect these maps and present them in these different ways that can show where our communities are. On the left, you can see the different reservations. So we've got our name for Minnesota comes from the Dakota language, Minnesota Mokoche, the land of clear smoky waters. And I cannot remember for the life of me where I found that map. I think I found it on social media. I was trying to cite it and just wrote, oops, on the slide. And this one on the right comes from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I like it because it also outlines where the counties are, county lines, but also where some of these major bodies of water are. And if you pay attention to where these county lines are drawn as well, it's kind of hard to see, like, up here around Red Lake where, geez, is this a laser pointer? I don't know. Just throw it. So where I come from anyway, Red Lake is up there. And I believe our land falls into about 11 different counties throughout the state, which causes a lot of issues if you know anything about politics and redlining and making sure that certain communities don't have that much political power. So that's because we probably have a pretty substantial population that prevents us from getting representatives in county offices. We still get some in there anyway, but like if we were to say do like a major election for like a county commissioner or something like that, there will be people actively working against anybody that's on the ballot that comes from our community. So just wanted to point that out as well. That's a major issue throughout the United States altogether. You may also notice that on the legend there that it says Anishinaabe or Ojibwe reservations in the northern half of the state. And underneath it's a Dakota communities. And that's part of a very complex history as well, which we'll get into. Essentially, the Dakota people, if you're not already aware, I hope you are, were exiled from the state of Minnesota after the 1862 war that they had with the United States. And later on, they ended up moving back into Minnesota and reestablishing communities that they had ended up buying back some land themselves. But as I understand it today, legally, they're still exiled. They're still banished from the state of Minnesota on the books, which is horrible to hear that here we are 150 years later and that hasn't even been repealed, despite the fact that we have a ton of Dakota people and that they have their creation story here. Basically right in the Twin Cities, kind of near where you see the Shakopee. So how a lot of the dispossession and displacement happened, there's a lot of parallels with what we're seeing happen right now over on the other side of the world with the conflicts between Palestine and Israel. And I came across this graphic that essentially shows how the land has been dispossessed over time. And a lot of when we look at historically with the early reservation system, once Native peoples were initially put on reservations, we actually had to get permission to be able to leave, to be able to go out to hunt, etc. Hunt, fish, gather, maintain our traditional food ways just to feed ourselves. So in that way, they ended up putting us dependent on government rations. If you were in the Changemaker talk earlier, Gary was talking very passionately about traditional foods and how we ended up stuck with all this white flour, sugar, everything that's just terrible for our health, and we're seeing all these health impacts to this day as a result. But not being able to leave your reservation, we were at our carrying capacity within a smaller, diminished land base, and you can't continue to hunt, fish, and gather without depleting your resources very rapidly on such a small piece of land. So going into way back with a lot of history, there was the Beaver War that happened over the course of about 100 years throughout the Ohio River Valley and throughout the Great Lakes region. This was leading up to the United States becoming an independent nation on its own. So at the time, there was two major sides. There was the English and the Dutch siding with the Iroquois. And of course the Iroquois, that's several different tribes as well. And then the French pairing with Algonquian tribes. Essentially the Iroquois and Algonquian are like two different language families that consist of many different tribal nations. So the entire region essentially became like a no man's land. Like people were fighting over rights to the beaver trade, which was essentially the beaver ended up being over harvested as well during that time. A lot of their pelts were just being sent back to Europe for fancy hats. And as a result, the beavers were almost wiped out. And a lot of just intertribal tensions as European nations were engaging in divide and conquer type of tactics to play different tribes against one another. The French and Indian War is essentially like a continuation of the Beaver War. And by disturbing the stability between tribes throughout the region through the divide and conquer tactics, that eased the westward military and settler encroachment into those western regions from the eastern United, well, what is now the eastern United States and eastern Canada, in westward towards the Great Lakes region. And of course, as tribes get displaced as well, that puts more pressure on the land the further west you go. So far, far away tribes as far west as, say, Iowa, the Dakotas, etc., they were seeing impacts of other tribes that are being pushed westward at that time as well. So jump ahead, because of course we've got a limited time, and we all know about the American Revolution. That's stuff that gets covered in curriculum in United States education. A lot of this doesn't. At this point, a lot of this, you can't even talk about it in schools without it becoming an issue about, yeah, very controversial. gets labeled CRT, critical race theory, things like that. But it's really, it's just telling the basic context of how everything came to be here. So anyway, jumping ahead, the Trail of the Tears happened throughout the 1830s to the 1850s. These were a lot of the tribes in the southeastern United States. So especially Georgia, Alabama. There was a series of court decisions. Sometimes they hear them called the Marshall Trilogy or the Marshall Decisions. That set the basis for federal Indian law and how the United States has this paternalistic relationship with tribes. In particular, that legislation, it labels tribes as domestic dependent nations. So that in and of itself is to declare that just sweeping across the rest of the continent is a really interesting way of trying to diminish sovereignty for 500 different nations. Of course, this is also tied in with what did they call that? The Doctrine of Discovery, and a lot of the documents that were coming out of the Vatican going way back that essentially gave essentially was justifying conquest of all these different non-Christian nations throughout the rest of the world. Not just the United States, not just North America or South America, but just worldwide this was happening. So anyway, this forced relocation that you're seeing is really why you find so many reservations, so few reservations east of the Mississippi. I know through some of my, for a while I was doing some work with the Transition to Organic Partnership Program, and people were trying to ask, like, well, we don't know where to find the Native American communities in Illinois. And all I could say was check in with the Chicago Indian Center, because at this point, a lot of the tribes have been expelled from there. There's still people that live there to these days, but there's no reservations that you'll find in Illinois, to my knowledge. And then there was also, when we, let's see, around 1850 also, there was an instance over not just Minnesota, but this was something that affected a lot of, jumping backwards, a lot of the tribes that were throughout this whole region that are affiliated with the Great Lakes Intertribal Fish and Wildlife Commission. So this was a instance called the Sandy Lake tragedy. And if you haven't heard about it, I encourage you to look it up. It was essentially it was an attempt at ethnic cleansing for a lot of the Great Lakes region. Many of these tribes that had engaged in the treaty making process and were thus now dependent on the annuity payments, all the sugar and flour and all that coming in that we are now dependent on, money and goods that were coming by treaty, all that was supposed to come to one particular location at La Pointe, which is La Pointe, I think that's considered Wisconsin, around Madeline Island, if I'm not mistaken. So while they had the annual payments had been coming there regularly, the federal government decided that they were going to change the location to Sandy Lake in Minnesota, which is near the Mille Lacs Reservation. And many, many families all had to travel westward to get there. The payment came late. They got essentially were being forced to stay there over the winter with inadequate shelter. And many families also tried to migrate back westward or back eastward, back to their homelands after collecting their payment. But in all, the Sandy Lake tragedy resulted in the death of about 400 people, either by exposure to the cold or by starvation. Jeez, I just tried to drink my microphone. Just really got that brain fog today. So another big thing that happened after that, throughout Minnesota, we also had the Nelson Act. This was also another attempt to remove all Ojibwe people to White Earth Reservation in northwestern Minnesota. It was not successful. There were a handful of different Ojibwe bands, in particular the Gull Lake Band, some people from Mille Lacs, a handful of people from even going up into the, we would call it like the Rainy Country, going up towards Rainy Lake, Boyce Fort Reservation. There was a handful of people that got all moved over to White Earth too. So White Earth is a pretty diverse place for Ojibwe people. We've lost a lot of our fluent speakers by this point. I think we're down to about 20 in the United States. I think I can name about 15 of them myself that I've know personally. But at White Earth in particular, before we had lost a lot of those speakers, it was even like linguistically a very diverse place because there were so many different dialects of Ojibwe that were spoken there. But a lot of that is, we're still trying to hold on to it. It's being taught over at the colleges and in the schools, but I don't believe there's any first language speakers left at White Earth. I was told that even at my own reservation in Red Lake, that we only have 4 fluent speakers left that were speaking it as their first language. Although a friend of mine, we tried to sit down and name them, and we ended up coming up with about 6 or 7. So I don't know where they got that 4 number. So again, this is just some of the treaties, not just the Glyphwick map, but specifically some of the treaty zones here in Minnesota. And also to illustrate with some of that context with the Dakota War, what happened in 1862, that was, at that time, the Dakota people were mostly confined just within a couple miles of the Minnesota River here. And just like what was happening in 1850 with the Sandy Lake tragedy and annuity payments coming late, their food payments were coming late as well. And there was a man, his name was something like Andrew Merrick. I might be mispronouncing that. But he ended up telling the Dakota people, well, if you're hungry, go eat grass like the buffalo. And then I can't find the exact quote, but when I learned about this when I was a kid, I remember hearing them follow up on that, expand a bit further. eat grass like the buffalo or their own dung. So as a result, the Dakota people went to war. And as a result, we're also expelled from the United States. I feel bad for glossing over that, but it's a complex history, and that deserves its own presentation on its own. And it's my people's history specifically, so I don't feel the most qualified to speak on that. So there's also some legislative history that I wanted to give some context on as well. There was the 1862 Morrill Act, which set up the land grab university system. Eventually, there was about $500 million worth of wealth. I believe this is accounting for inflation by today's money. About $500 million worth of wealth channeled into the University of Minnesota. From, that should say leases, not leaves. I thought I fixed that. From leases and land sales after the Dakota exile. And today, the university's permanent trust fund controls roughly $600 million in royalties from iron ore mining, timber sales, and other revenues derived from lands taken from Dakota and Ojibwe peoples. This has been established by through research. There was a report that recently came out just last year called the Truth Report. You can find some great articles on Minnesota Public Radio's website about it. But there was four researchers that essentially went into the university's archives. They dug up a lot of the founding documents. This is before Minnesota was even a state, and found how a lot of the men that were in charge in Minnesota, that you see a lot of these streets named after throughout St. Paul and our county names, so like Sibley, Ramsey, etc., how they and some of the founders of the university essentially architected this whole sense, this whole extraction of wealth from lands that were expropriated from indigenous peoples. And it's about a 500-page document. I saw them pull it out in a box. It's like that thick. So 1862 was also when the Homestead Act was passed. So a lot of settlers coming into the prairies and into a lot of the farmland throughout the United States were able to get 160-acre plots at about $1.25 an acre. A couple decades later, 1887, exactly 100 years before I was born to the day, February 8th, the Dawes General Allotment Act was also passed. So this was a piece of legislation that was supposed to break up land that tribes were still holding and to give specific acreage to individual, like male heads of household, so to speak. And wouldn't you know it, they decided that there was also surplus lands. So with those surplus lands, they were often auctioned off or sold to the highest bidder. They were also gifted to a lot of traders that would just point out, like, well, that Indian there owes me money. So they say, well, you can have his land in return. So that's just another instance of how more land was being taken. In Minnesota in particular, the Nelson Act was supposed to be what was setting up a lot of these allotments, tribes in particular. My tribe, Red Lake, rejected the Allotment Act. So it's actually two. Sorry, I don't know if my mic is cutting out. I feel like it has been, but it's actually, Red Lake is actually one of two reservations in the United States that is unallotted, that all the land is held in common. The other reservation is Warm Springs, Oregon, and the only reason why that one didn't go through the allotment process is because they were too small. it didn't make sense to divide up land to that many people when it was that small of land, so they just decided to hold it all in common there as well. But with Red Lake, our leaders actually approached the United States government and said, no, we will not be party to this. You cannot do this. This isn't even how we view land ownership. Like, we hold all this together. And they ended up giving up, I believe it was an additional 300 million acres in exchange for control of Red Lake, upper and lower, in its entirety. But throughout that whole process, I cannot remember this guy's name, but he ended up, he agreed to Red Lake that as long as the grass grows and the water flows, that Red Lake would, upper and lower, would belong to Red Lake people forever. And our people made him stand up and speak that out to the four directions, to the east, south, west, and north. And then sure enough, he took that agreement back to Washington with him. But by the time the news got back to Red Lake leaders, there was about 3/8 of Upper Red Lake, the northeastern corner, had just been chopped off of that map. So to this day, where Red Lake should be entirely belonging to Ojibwe people, that 3/8, that piece of shoreline there and extending somewhat into the water, they view that as like state land now. So it's become a huge commercial fishing location. There's a handful of resorts there. A lot of people go there for their big fishing trips and everything. And it's just like a really hot location. And on the other hand, we could be running those resorts and generating some economic benefits for our people as well. But it's just not the case. And I think they really wanted to share that lake anyhow. Check, check. All right. All right, where was I? So to this day, we consider that Red Lake is being, at least that portion of Upper Red Lake is being illegally occupied. And our leaders are currently trying to get it back. It's hard to see that it's become like this multi-million dollar like industry to have all this commercial, well, not even commercial fishing, but like sports fishing happening up there. And year after year, we see people just dumping human waste into the lake too, because they don't live there, and they already are, because they know that the land is in contest. You know, it's almost just kind of like a intentional slap in the face, I think. And also, the way that it's being done is just, it's ridiculous. I don't know if you have heard any of the news coming out of Red Lake over this winter. I'm sure I don't need to tell you all that this winter was very odd and very, very unseasonably warm. A lot of lakes didn't really freeze over like they typically do, and Red Lake is no exception. There was somebody that tried to land their plane on thin ice and crashed into the lake, actually, just a couple weeks ago. And truck after truck sinking in, and we keep trying to tell them, you know, like, pay attention to what we're doing. You know, we've been living here for quite a while, and even though we've only been in, say, at Red Lake for maybe a few hundred years, because there was Dakota people there before us, we have that relationship with the lake. We know the little nuances about, you know, if it's going to be kicking up ice on the shore. We know if we should be going out. We know if there's going to be a shift of wind that that ice is going to be really unstable or could break. So if people would pay attention or listen to us, you know, maybe they wouldn't be ending up with their expensive equipment polluting our lake. Oh, and I also had that graphic up there as well. It mentioned some of the prices per acre as well in these different states as well. Essentially, this was some of the, advertisements that was coming out around 1910. So after the Homestead Act had already passed and everything, but they were still continuing to sell a lot of this land off to farmers. So now here's some of the more recent federal Indian law and legislation that is continuing to affect us. At this point, it was starting to give us a bit more, you know, quote-unquote freedoms, if you can call it that, living within this entire situation. Essentially, I'll back up a little bit. So the reservation system, especially in the Western United States, was essentially treated like a prisoner of war camps. So, like, we weren't allowed to leave, and yeah, just this whole diminished landscape. I just wanted to mention about the prisoner of war camps and also about how a lot of the extermination happened. As I understand it, how I've been taught, Hitler actually got a lot of his inspiration for how to set up concentration camps after looking at what had happened in the Americas here. So just the way that all this history is repeating in different parts of the world. You know, I had also showed the map of what's happening in Palestine as well, and how people, they get cut off from food supplies as well. There's a lot of parallels. It just keeps repeating, you know, century after century. And that's something that we really need to break as a species, as human beings. So anyway, some of this federal law that we have, American Indian people finally became citizens in 1924 with the Indian Citizenship Act. Later on, there was a era that we call termination and relocation. So as a result of that, there was about 78% of people today that are living off reservation. And what would that be? Only about 22 that are still within our original treaty lands. Within the land that we still hold title to within those treaty lands. This poster here was part of the relocation programs that the federal government had set up. Essentially, they were trying to get Native people to move off of their lands once again to move into these urban environments such as Denver, Minneapolis, Seattle, etc., Detroit. Hey, I thought that was my alarm. And the way that they were advertising it was they were just trying to get everybody to join the workforce, to seek out a better life, have a nice home. You'll get training for different types of jobs, you'll get education, and just trying to sell people to just move off of their homelands. And of course, you know what happens when people move off of their homelands, and especially in this context, they want to take all the rest of that land that's there, all of the natural resource wealth that's there, whether it's timber, whether it's iron ore, whether it's any other like type of minerals. That was essentially the motivation, the driving factor for the United States. Ironically, it was Richard Nixon that ended the termination and termination policies anyway. So termination, they were trying to tell tribes, we don't recognize you as a tribe anymore. You're not Indians. You're not living like you used to. And of course, how can we? I say we in this historical context. But this happened to the Menominee people here in Wisconsin as well. It's a major part of American Indian history throughout the United States. But Richard Nixon, of all people, was the one to end it. And as I understand it, is because he was a big football fan and was a big fan of the football team at the Carlisle Indian School, where they had actually developed the modern game as we know it today. So there was also the American Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act of 1975, which essentially enabled our tribal communities, tribal governments, to tribal organizations as well, to start applying for grants. And today our communities are basically living off of grants, surviving off of grants. This is a lot of how we've seen a lot of our modernization. A lot of our programs that are still existing today were built off of being able to apply for that money. And of course, today we still see issues with even trying to apply for some of these grants. Say we're applying for a Minnesota Department of Agriculture grant. You consider that 1% of the farms in Minnesota are owned by BIPOC people, and even just a fraction of that 1% belongs to Native people. The other 99% belongs to settler-descended communities. Just looking at that demographic, who do you think is the ones that are doing the grant reviews? And with some of our communities, like say Red Lake, you know, there we have like certain ways that we're viewed or stereotypes that we still have to beat. So, you know, I don't want to say that this happens all the time. You know, there's a lot of measures in place for equity as well. But having applied for some of these grants myself, you'll get told, like, well, how come this isn't there? And it's like, it's clearly right here. But anyway, I digress. But so later on, there was also in 1978, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. The Constitution of the United States should have been having that for everybody within the First Amendment. But Native American peoples, we got that in 1978. Our spirituality, our ways of life, our traditional ceremonial lodges were outlawed until that point. Nothing in that cup. And just for a little bit of context, because a lot of people like to say that this is all ancient history and why are you complaining about this? It happened 100 years ago. My dad was 18. When that happened, and you think about if your family wasn't able to openly practice their ways of life until your parents' generation, when they were already an adult of age that they can have kids as well, there's a lot of intergenerational compounding effects that happen there as well. So I know Gary in the presentation with the changemaker, he had mentioned that a lot of people had to keep these ways secret just to be able to maintain them. There are people that would have to do these ceremonies far off into the woods just to be able to maintain our songs, to maintain our language, to maintain our ceremonial teachings, our creation stories, all of that. And I'm really grateful, and to even throughout my life, you know, a lot of this has remained secret. People are still very quiet about it. I'm only just now starting to see youth become much more open about it. And perhaps even for me and my parents' generation, we might even be a little bit off put by how open they are with it. But it's just to put it into that historical context, to know that, you know, this was only 9 years before I was born that we had this sense of religious freedom. Also, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. So this is for a lot of the, human remains that were used for a scientific study that were held by federal institutions and museums. Essentially NAGPRA, this piece of legislation made it so that it's illegal for them to hold on to them. The University of Minnesota is still holding on to some remains over at the Weissman Art Museum. And the last I heard, they were trying to figure out for their insurance purposes how much they're worth. And you still tell them, well, they're not worth anything. You can't legally sell them. You're supposed to send them back to where they belong. They need to be sent back for reburial. And also, this also comes up in a lot of other contexts when there's different development that's, or quote-unquote development, that's happening throughout the United States. Different easement projects, Department of Transportation, coming across bones, things like that. There's a lot of protocols that are in place now, but those protocols weren't even developed or being put into place until about 1990. And then finally, the Native American Languages Act of 1994. By this point, I was 7 years old. Before that, there wasn't the support, or I'm not even sure if it was the legal right to be able to use our languages as the medium for educational instruction. Today, we have immersion schools that are trying to retain what we still do have. But as I mentioned, our fluent speakers are very few and far between now, about 20 throughout the United States that are first language speakers that grew up with it. So the clock is really ticking for us to be able to maintain these, because our languages, they developed over the course of millennia. Here in this land, our languages are tied to our land, like grammatically. They form our ways of thought and interrelationality with our environment. It comes across in our grammar. It comes across in our words that we use. And if we're not maintaining that, how do we maintain our sense of self? And as a result, that's why we start to see so many different issues start to come out in communities as well throughout history. You start to see this alcoholism, this homelessness, etc., addiction. And as I mentioned, I went through that myself as well. So this is just all part of that history and how it's also tied in with our food systems and our relationship with our land. So in 2007, the United Nations put out their Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which define owner rights to cultural and ceremonial expression, identity, language, employment, health, education, and other issues. And foodways they're interwoven into every one of those things. I'll also note that Canada was actually really fighting it. I think it was Canada and New Zealand were actively fighting against a lot of the wordings with how it passed over the course of about 10 or 20 years as it was being worked on. There's a lot of articles that you can find online about that as well, too. So I think I've actually covered a lot of those. But I did not touch on that, the 1898 Battle of Sugar Point, which happened in Leech Lake Reservation. So that would be kind of north central Minnesota around here. And that's where I'm tying it back into the Walker Art Center with how I started my conversation here today as well. So essentially there was a lot of logging, timber industry that was happening throughout the northern Minnesota. And there was a man named T.B. Walker that was down in the Twin Cities at the time. Didn't have much money to his name, but he ended up making his way up north. And through his time just being a guide for a lot of these loggers and people that were exploring through the region, he started to learn a lot more about the landscape, a lot more about the woods that are there, and the value of it as well. Flash forward maybe a couple decades later, he ended up becoming one of the most rich men in the world based off of all the timber that he was extracting from northern Minnesota in particular, but also places like California as well. So he was just big time timber baron. And in particular, the way that things were happening around Leech Lake, our people were complaining that a lot of these loggers were harvesting this, they were not allowed to take the fresh trees. They were only able to take a category of timber called deadwood at the time. So as a result, they would go through and intentionally start forest fires so that they could pass off some of this, these live trees as deadwood, and then clear cut. I know one of my colleagues here at Marble Seed, he told me about some of the descriptions that he read of those forests before they were logged, and that just the sheer size of these trees, he said, like, if people could see these forests today, they would weep. So there's very, very, very few old growth forests that remain throughout Minnesota and probably a lot of the United States. So this is just like my case study to show, because these were things that happened. It's like a microcosm of everything that happened throughout a lot of the Americas, not just the United States, but well into Canada and all the way down into Argentina. But anyway, so they were doing a lot of this illegal clear cutting, and our people were getting upset about it over at Leech Lake. So as a result, at one point, one of our leaders was being arrested, and he had been arrested several times before, and they were trying to take him to Duluth. I think at one point he had been taken to Duluth, which is here, I'll point it out on the map if you're not familiar. Essentially from Leech Lake all the way to over here to make them stand trial or go to jail for a while. But oftentimes they would end up throwing out the charges and forcing people to walk all the way home. So as a result of having to deal with that and having to walk home at least once, our people weren't having it. And there was some people trying to arrest him for like drunkenness. And our Leech Lake Pillager Band people went in and de-arrested him. So I think it was within a day or two later, there was some military people that were going off over to Bear Island on Leech Lake, where he had a cabin over on the east side near the what's now known as Federal Dam. And they went over there to try to re-arrest him. And what they didn't know, because they didn't really understand the layout of the land, it was that the Leech Lake pillagers had them surrounded. So firefight occurred. The United States, I believe it was like a Minnesota militia at that time, they ended up losing contact with their people out in Washington and everywhere else. And if you were to look at some of the news articles that came out in the Minneapolis Star, I believe at the time, what has become the Star Tribune, they started putting out all these articles saying that there was another massacre that happened, that all of them were dead. And it wasn't the case. It's just that they lost contact and they started to worry and they took it to the news. So there was a lot of panic that started happening. There was a regiment from the army that got dispatched out there to Leech Lake. And by then, things had calmed down. None of our people ended up resulted as a result. I think I worded that strangely. None of our people were arrested as a result of that. And a delegation of leaders from Leech Lake ended up traveling to, I can't remember if they traveled or not, but they put together a statement that basically complained about these logging practices that were happening, and how it was just very, interrupting their food system, how it was interrupting the natural world, everything that was there, all the animals that had their homes there. Just put it out there. I think they called them these very bad men, is how they said it in English in that letter. But now There ended up being, I believe, Chippewa National Forest, which is like that was formed as a result of these logging practices. Just over the past couple years, now Chippewa National Forest is under shared stewardship with the Leech Lake Band. But it took about at least 100 years of trying to advocate for that. So let's see. Okay. I also wanted to share this because, as I mentioned, there was something that we reserve called usufructuary rights within our treaties. And that's the right to hunt, fish, and gather within ceded lands and territories. I'll keep going. I got the 5-minute warning. So we retain the usufructuary rights to hunt, fish, and gather within ceded territories. And as you would have it, the state, the government, whoever, a lot of these ceded territories ended up in turn becoming privately owned lands, whether it's farmland, whether it's corporate land, whether it's individuals that maintain their homesteads, municipalities, etc. And most people, they would argue, nobody can come on my land, you would be trespassing. But under international law, under treaty law, those usufructuary rights stand. And technically, native peoples within those treaties can still go on that land and engage in their treaty rights. However, if most people were to do that, they risk getting shot. So, oftentimes these usufructuary rights do not get exercised to the extent that we legally could. But I just wanted to put that out there so people understand that context, that we're taking it easy on everybody else and that land that's there as well. And we haven't been exercising it to that extent. But as far as public lands go, we still do go out onto public lands and we harvest as well. So this map that I'm sharing here is provided by Great Lakes Intertribal Fish and Wildlife Commission. This is for modern native people over the past couple decades or so, practicing their usufructuary rights within these treated territories. And they've essentially been harassed for years for just being able to hunt, fish, and gather. And you can see with the legend here that the red pins are for instances of firearms discharging or fireworks. I've even heard stories of pipe bombs back in the 90s. Objects being thrown are that's kind of pinkish. I'm a little colorblind. The yellow pins are for verbal harassment or threats, and the gray pins would be other. Do we have any commercial sports fishermen in the room? I always figure that there's some overlap, especially being in Wisconsin. But by contrast, this is also this is a map provided by landbacklandforward.com. This is a project that somebody started where they were trying to document and set these pins where individual landowners who stand in solidarity with Indigenous peoples or BIPOC peoples in general are willing to open up their lands to people that want to hunt, fish, or gather. If you were to click on each of these pins, this is just a screenshot, so I can't click it. It tells you where it is, there's contact information, what grows there, if they have streams going through it, what the land is like. But as you can see, there's only 6 pins in the entire United States. And how many pins do you see here in Wisconsin? So this is the type of harassment that we're continuing to see just in practicing our modern food systems today. Aside from all of the different impacts of quote-unquote development, whether that be runoff from any number of different things, anything from agriculture to the transportation systems, industry, etc. Everything that is considered progress that's making the world run these days. But as we know, you know, it's preaching to the choir here with people that are into sustainability and regenerative practices. All that is just, we're on a trajectory for disaster, you know. We're seeing it in the climate right now. So just wanted to present that as a little bit of juxtaposition, and also for natives that are trying to buy their lands back today. This is from a article called Three Nebraska Tribes Are Buying Back Farmland and Attempting to Reverse History, that was published by Investigate Midwest just this past October. And I'll read it really quick. So, in the past few years, both the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska and the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska have made small and large land purchases. The Iowa Tribe added 4 acres next to some land it already owned, and the Ponca made a 36-acre land buy. Neither is notable except for the price tag, more than $43,000 per acre. And Chris Steinbeck, of the Oglala Lakota and president of Indian Land Tenure Foundation, says, "I don't see too many places where anything approaching that happens. I mean, 40,000 is an acre is a lot." And when I've talked to a handful of other people across Wisconsin and other places, they're also seeing similar practices. Maybe not as high as 40,000 or 43,000, but still like 11,000, 17,000 per acre, when the average is more like 4 or 7. And why do you think that is? You know, for me, when I think about it, I think it's either they're trying to price us out or they're trying to cash out. But that's just another injustice when you think of it in this entire historical context of how everything has happened and how little we still retain to this day. So to be charged to that extent, and for us to give even more of what little capital we do have, is just shocking. So I really hope that there could be some federal protections in place to keep these prices down, because this is absolutely ridiculous. And because our land and our connection to it is tied to our waters, our medicines, our ceremonial bundles, our cosmology, our ways of life, our values, our languages, our communities, and our culture, it is extremely important that we still have access to land, and that we have land for Indigenous people to be able to live on. I don't believe that necessarily means trying to send everybody else out of the United States. You know, that's a ridiculous assumption, I think, because there's so many people that have arrived here by diaspora and by no means of their own, that may not have ever left their homelands if they had didn't have a reason to, that they weren't being forced off themselves. So I don't expect people to just up and leave or anything like that. I think that really what we need is this deeper sense of interrelationality amongst ourselves. And just there has to be some kind of medium for it, because at this point I feel like there's so many people I encounter that, you know, they've never met a Native person. They don't know how to interact with one or start a conversation about any of these things. But I think this concept of land back just tends to scare people, that, you know, it's like, well, what about me? Where am I supposed to go, you know? So I just wanted to give some of these contexts. I have a very long list of ways that it can happen. And, you know, it's not necessarily up to individuals, but it can happen on an individual, on a municipal, on various different levels. But, you know, Native peoples were often the largest employers in the counties that we're operating in. So what's the difference besides that and say, like, something that's operated by a county, you know, it's just a different landlord. But anyway, so there's a lot of different recent examples, because like I mentioned, calling for land back, I remember when I presented at that Upper Midwest Farmland Summit, I was told, be reasonable, you know. So here's some reasonable examples from just the past couple years. So co-management of national parks, this is with the Department of the Interior, in the town of Ball Club at Leech Lake Reservation, you know, a lot of our reservations are checkerboarded, but the town of Ball Club is actually named after our traditional lacrosse sticks. And there's a family that's, they hold land on the southern side of Ball Club Lake. They invited our community to come play the game on their land. And that was extremely meaningful to me as somebody that plays that game, because that's part of our culture, that's part of our ways, that's part of our ceremonies back. And that's also relationship building. You know, they didn't necessarily give up their land, but they're showing solidarity with us, you know, and, you know, they're breaking bread with us, you know. And there's a lot of people that they might just be living right on the border of the reservation that, you know, they don't necessarily treat us all that well. You know, even when I just go to the grocery store, there's guys hanging out in trucks that are just being all somehow picking fights with people out there. So, you know, as I mentioned, there's the Land Back, Land Forward map, Spirit Knob on Lake Minnetonka. There's an artist, her name is Marlena Miles. She just happened to meet some very, very mega wealthy landowner that happened to have a home on Lake Minnetonka, and in his backyard is a Dakota spiritual site. So just by talking to him and explaining this, they ended up talking it out. She connected him with Shakopee, and they're trying to work it out so that it can be returned to indigenous stewardship there as well. More examples of co-stewardship, even just instances of, like, say, the city of Oakland giving 5 acres to Sogorete Land Trust. And it goes on and on and on and on and on just over the past couple years. So I don't think I really have the time to go into those since we've got like 5 minutes left, but I wanted to pose these questions for you all to ask yourselves as individuals and as organizations. What is the indigenous history of the land that you occupy? What are the indigenous place names for locations or landmarks in your area? What indigenous nation is closest to you? How do you pronounce their name? What are their goals for the future? What native-led organizations are near you? Do any volunteer land taxes exist in your community? And there is some in Minnesota, particularly for Dakota peoples. What issues are impacting the indigenous communities and people near you? How can you support indigenous land rights? How can we learn from and work with indigenous peoples in a way that is equitable, non-extractive, and builds positive community relationships? What do you want from Indigenous peoples? What do Indigenous peoples want from you? And have you ever wondered if your house is built on an Indian burial ground? Because they exist everywhere. So anyway, Miigwech Bizendawiyeg, Pinigigi Waywenon, Yako. Thank you all for listening to me. I've got my contact information up here. A few more links and resources. Hopefully I can get the slides out for people that may be interested. So thank you all for listening. Miigwech. And I'm open to taking any questions for anybody that has the time. I know we pushed up until about five before, but I'll stay later. So. All right. All right, so she asked me that there's this link here that says join the NRO, and she asked, what is the NRO? So the NRO is called the New Red Order, and it's actually, they're kind of like a trickster art collective that's, they're based all the way from Alaska on down. I've done some, collaboration with them. But essentially anybody who is working in collaboration with Indigenous peoples and working towards these means that I'm pushing for, you can claim yourself as being part of that as well.
Real quick, folks, as you're leaving, if you don't mind, come scan the code here. Please submit a session evaluation. We want to give some feedback to Marvel's lead about how this works.
Any other questions? Comments or complaints? These ones here? All right.
Yep.
So in Minnesota, do you have the same legacy of the spearfishing controversy like Northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I was asked if in Minnesota we have the same controversy as there was in Wisconsin with the spearfishing. And essentially, yes. I feel like, at least within my lifetime, I've heard it more with netting, but I believe so with spearing as well. There's a lot of articles that have come up out about it. Also, there's a great book that Larry Nesper wrote called The Walleye Wars. And that describes a lot of that history, particularly in Wisconsin, but there was also major court cases that came out of Minnesota that cemented these usufructuary rights as well.
Is there any ongoing like, work around that, like
peacework? I'm being asked if there's any ongoing work around that or piecework around it, and I know there still are like. We call them treaty demonstrations. Some people call them fishing protests. But essentially, I often see that, like particularly around Leech Lake, other communities as well, we will exercise our rights by just going out one day before the official opener. And as a result, the Minnesota DNR will often come out and confiscate nets, cut nets, things like that, issue citations, but drop the charges so that it doesn't go to court. So it just perpetuates year after year.
Do they give you your stuff back?
I'm being asked if they give our stuff back. I don't know. I haven't been in that situation myself. I usually just hear more of the dialogue around the court cases and how it's being dropped. They don't mention that in the when I'm looking at the articles. And I've never asked any of my friends that have been involved in that, so that's a good question.
I'm just curious what other kind of regenerative projects or land stewardship projects that you're involving yourself in as of late, or what else have you been working on?
So I was asked what other type of regenerative or restorative practices that I've been working on personally that are related to all this. So after one of the last times I actually did this presentation and didn't quite articulate it as fully, I was reached out to by a 501c3 nonprofit that told me that they're interested in working in on land back within the Arrowhead region of Minnesota, northeastern Minnesota, that's in the 1854 treaty zone. And I'm not under that treaty myself, so I told them, you know, I'm not sure I'm the right person. I can connect you in with the right people. I can provide some educational resources, but I'm not necessarily the one to do that. So I did connect them in with a lot of that, and I told them about these, like the land back, land forward map, for instance, And it sounds like, I'm trying to help guide them a little bit, but it sounds like they're trying to talk to some of the landowners, and there's a lot of concentrated wealth going up the north shore of Lake Superior as well, and privately owned land, but it sounds like they're reaching out to some of these people and organizations that do hold some of this land and seeing if any of them are interested in participating in that type of land back, land forward type of thing, or if they're at least interested in putting it out there more publicly that they are in support and solidarity of Indigenous people practicing those rights on their land so that we know we won't get shot. So... Anyone else? Well, I thank you all, Miigwech. I won't hold you.